mission to the planet. But the Trace spacecraft did successfully get into Mars orbit, and today it's sending back good science. It's studying methane and chemicals in the atmosphere at Mars. It's also got a NASA radio on board, an electric radio. NASA supplied that to ESA, the European Space Agency, agreed to use their radio. And one good thing about it is now we can use that as a repeater for anything that we land on a planet, the rovers or any other future landing craft. We have the InSight that's going to be landing probably the end of 2018, beginning of 2019. You'll have the InSight mission landing. So it'll be a good backup. Some of our orbiting spacecraft are getting a little old. Let me drop it. Okay, now in April, we wound up with the Bigelow Habitat Module sent up to the International Space Station successfully on a Dragon spacecraft launched by SpaceX. So that docked with the space station, and then about a month or so later, started to inflate. NASA started to inflate it, and it became another module on the space station. It'll stay there for 2 years, and I guess that'll be another year and a half probably from now, and they'll deorbit that and burn it up. But right now, you know, they could open a door and use it as another module for now. In the future, they'll be able to make bigger ones, and this is done by Bigelow, a private company located in Las Vegas, making these things. He plans on building the Bigelow 330, humongous, one of these things, and he's trying to get NASA to approve attaching it to the ISS. Also in that month, they launched another Cygnus spacecraft. Cygnus spacecraft has always been launched from Wallops Island in Virginia, not too far from here. And back in two Octobers ago, they had one blow up, the engine that they were using, an NK-33 old Russian engine, failed. And since then, they decided to go with completely different engines. But in the meantime, they had a contract with NASA to still send cargo up on their Cygnus spacecraft. So they made a deal with United Launch Alliance, ULA, which launches most of the rockets for NASA.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Canceled.
Cape Canaveral. And it went up successfully on an Atlas V rocket. Okay, very good. Since then, there was Progress launches. Progress went up. I remember seeing that live on the computer. Any of the Progress missions, they're the ones that the Russians launch for us themselves, their resupply missions to the space station. And they had problems earlier in the year, toward the end of 2015. So this was the first one that, since that problem, that went up successfully and attached to the space station. So I was glad to see that, but unfortunately, just a month ago, they did have another problem with their Progress vehicle separating from the Proton rocket. That one wound up burning up in the atmosphere. So they're still working on that problem, trying to straighten that out. Another name that we talk about on the net is a fellow named Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos owns a company called Blue Origin. Blue Origin launches presently unmanned rockets, but will be manned shortly. By the way, Jeff Bezos is the owner of Amazon. If you haven't bought anything from Amazon, he's the guy that is on top. Well, he's very interested in the space program. He's got billions of dollars now pouring into the space program. And building something called the New Shepard. We you followed his flights many, many times. And in April, he did have another flight of the New Shepard, pleasantly unmanned, but it's a capsule on top, a spacecraft on top of a booster that goes into space suborbitally. He launched it in Texas, West Texas, and it goes up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
This successfully. The booster comes down and lands vertically. Comes right down to near the land. The rocket comes on. Light landing legs come out, and he's done this the same time, same rocket, same booster, now 5 times. By the end of the year, he's done it a couple of more times. Let me drop it. And also then we have first success of right after that launch. This was a launch of SpaceX. He was sending SES-9 satellite to geosynchronous orbit for a private company, and he landed successfully for the first time a booster out on out of 400 miles out down the ocean on the barge called he has a name for it. He names it after science fiction books. He reads a lot of science fiction books. This guy, Elon Musk. So he named it after one of the boats or spacecraft in a book called Of Course I Still Love You. Well, it worked out for him. Picked the right name. He wound up successfully finally doing that. Although he did it on land with Cape Canaveral. It was a night flight. He landed back at Launch Complex 13 that SpaceX has also taken over. He's got three launch complexes now down in Florida. And he really wanted to land this thing out at sea. What happens? He can't bring them all back to land. It's a light that's pushing a spacecraft all the way to geosynchronous orbit. The first stage is way too far out at sea to bring it back, so he has to land it on this autonomous drone. Can't believe it. I haven't timed this thing out yet, but we're getting there. I talked about the beam. The beam during that month was successfully opened up, and Jeff Williams, one of the astronauts, pumped it up slowly, and they had some problems. I remember watching that on the computer. Open a valve, close it, open and close, and they realized that it was sitting in storage inside the at NASA so long that it was kind of like creased together. So they eventually started putting more pressure into this thing, and they got it open, and they, like I said before, they were very happy. They can now open the door, go inside. They take readings, tests, make sure it's safe for astronauts to be in there on a regular basis, and that'll probably come to pass. So far, it's been in there, what, 6, 7, 8 months longer, and they've had no problems with this inflatable room that they have attached to the space station, attached to the Tranquility node. Another thing we talked about the all the different spacecraft that's around planets. We have Cassini and the ones in the past, Galileo, and now there's one going around Venus that Japan successfully got in orbit. They launched one 5 years ago, and they missed the planet, and since then it's went around the sun. So 5 years has gone by, and it came near Venus again, and they managed to actually get it into orbit.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
On the list all the way in, you had Mercury. We had Messenger there for a couple of years in orbit around that by the United States. Then after that, we had Venus. This is the first spacecraft to orbit Venus. We had one called Magellan that orbited for probably 5, 6 years using radar to look at the surface But this is the latest one. It happens to be by Japan. And then all the way out, we know about Earth, of course, satellites, Mars. We have quite a few satellites there. And Jupiter's been visited by Galileo in orbit around it. And then Cassini and flyby of Uranus and Neptune. And, of course, another flyby by New Horizons, which is still going. Drop it. With so much data coming back from that New Horizon flight that went past Pluto, that at this time, mid-year anyway, probably around May, New Horizon had only sent about half their amount of data back to Earth. Well, that time has gone by, and we now have 100% of their data, and it's on its way now out to the Kuiper Belt, which Dick was talking about before, and it's actually going to visit a Kuiper Belt object called MU69. So we'll see how it goes. That'll be on New Year's Eve 2019, so just 3 years from now. And that's another milestone for this thing. They finally got approval. Because they could do these things, that doesn't mean that somebody's going to pay for it. Alan Stern, the principal investigator, is still involved in the push for this Kuiper Belt object, which wasn't even discovered when this spacecraft was launched a little over 10 years ago. It was actually discovered by the Hubble Space Telescope. So let me drop it. Another thing we discussed about all the different spaceports around the world, and during the month of May, Russia got to open up another spaceport at Boskochny, far, far eastern location, and they launched a Soyuz spacecraft from that location. It cost many billions of dollars to build the spaceport, and we'll be seeing more of that. More action from that spaceport in years to come. They'll be launching people eventually from there. Let's see. Now, we also have China has always been in the news. Not only do they launch spacecraft, now they're building antennas. They built something called the FAST, the 500-meter aperture spherical telescope out in China somewhere, and 500 meters in diameter, compared to roughly 300 meters that Arecibo in Puerto Rico has. But I understand that's online, and maybe that's looking for ET. As far as the club goes, and our Weimark club is always involved with whatever's new, and they're always involved with the Cradle of Aviation. So again, they were there actually in May 20th for Lindenberg's anniversary when he took off from that from Roosevelt Field. The world was over there, and they've gone over there for the Apollo 11 anniversary.
Yeah. I got a hot
shot. It was a great place last year. Let me drop it. Kepler's telescope, that's still active, finding a lot of 5,000 some odd candidates. Now it's confirmed over 3,000. I think around 3,000 are verified. So and the number keeps climbing. Even so, it's on a what they call an extended mission, K2. Still finding more planets, and very happy about that. And that will eventually have another actually space telescope, I'll call it, to help it out, called TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. TESS is going to be going up this year. Probably mid-year or September, I think. I'll have to check the date, but definitely 2017, and that's going to be launched on a private company's spacecraft rocket called Falcon 9, launch out of Cape Canaveral. And I think it was the end of, I'll have to check, I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was December of 2017. So that'll be activated in 2018. And that will also be looking for planets, actually nearby planets. Kepler looks for distant planets, you know, where this will look a couple of hundred light years out, looking at nearby planets. Going to have a very unusual orbit. Going to go out to the orbit of the moon and come back around the Earth. And the
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Talk about CubeSats quite a bit. I know there was one school, the Thomas More School, St. Thomas More, come out of Virginia. They built their own CubeSats, and it was launched on a Cygnus cargo spacecraft from the United States and wound up on the space station. The space station has the capability of sending out little CubeSats from the Kaibo module. And theirs went out. I don't think they ever got a signal, but a bunch of young people built it, and that's what I'm always in favor of. Anything like that to get them interested in building little satellites. Next thing you know, they're going to grow up and start building big satellites. There's been a lot of work by Lockheed Martin that wants to build an actual space station. There's no money funded for it yet, but they have plans. They submitted it to NASA to actually put a space station around Mars. And they'd like to do that to eventually help out when NASA eventually gets to the point of that they want to land on Mars. So if they can get space station orbiting that planet, say 10 years from now, they'd be very happy. But no contracts have been signed. But we talked about that on the net. Well, now, keep in line with all these different countries. India is involved. They actually launched a space plane that didn't go into orbit, went around the Earth once and landed in the Pacific Ocean. And they just wanted to see if it would work. It had some kind of engine on board.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Canceled.
I mentioned that they eventually want to use, it'll start off as a cargo type vehicle, and eventually they hope to have people on board probably 20 years from now. That was their first attempt. It's very similar looking to the X-37B. X-37B is our spy satellite that goes up, stays up for a year or two, and comes back and lands on wheels. Looks like a small space shuttle. Lands out in Vandenberg Air Force Base. In fact, we still have one up there now. It's been up there like a year and a half. And eventually that will come back. This is WSQN. So they, you know, India's launched a lot of rockets. They've put a lot of satellites into geosynchronous orbit. They've sent a spacecraft now orbiting Mars called the MOM spacecraft. So, you know, if anybody doesn't think there's some kind of a little space race going on, not only between countries, but they also have it going between companies. You have construction by Boeing. Boeing is constructing not only buildings, but the CST-100 Starliner. It's going to be able to carry four people. You'll see that probably first launch next year. They'll start off with an unmanned flight, and then right after that, they'll have a manned flight up to the International Space Station. After that, the Starliner will be certified, and they'll have, on a routine basis, you'll have four people leaving Cape Canaveral on an Atlas V rocket to the space station. Spacecraft will attach to the space station. It'll stay there for sometimes a half a year or more, detach, come back, and land with parachutes. And their goal is eventually to have the parachutes also land on land. Reusable vehicle, probably up to 10 times per shot, similar to the Dragon. The Dragon crew vehicle will be very similar in that respect. Now, another spacecraft that was launched actually in 2015, but they got good results on it, was the LISA program. And the LISA program was launched by European Space Agency, and that was designed to study gravitational waves. And they sent that to the L1 position, Lagrange Point 1, which is about 1,000,000 miles away from Earth. And it turned out it was very successful because of that, probably in 2030. Now, because of the success, maybe they'll push it up earlier. They'll send out another, much more advanced system to detect gravity waves. We talked about the complexity of how it worked, but I don't want to get into that now, but make a long story short, if you put something out in space and set it up where nothing can make it move, not even photons from the sun, and you know it's not going to move, and you see something move in relation to another something.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They believe that they have equipment now that they can do that, so probably 2030. European Space Agency will probably try it out again with a much more sophisticated spacecraft. We talked about Curiosity a lot. That's the rover riding around on Mars. Now there's another one being built. It's going to be sent out in 2020, the little Mars rover 2020. Got a lot of interesting equipment on board. It's got a piece of equipment called MOTSI, which will take the atmosphere out of Mars and it'll make oxygen. The goal is to try to see if you could make oxygen out of the atmosphere of Mars. And it's a proof of concept type of thing. If it works out, then they know that if you send bigger machines like that to Mars into the future, it'll be a step in making oxygen for not only people to breathe, but oxygen for spacecraft. One of the pieces of equipment on board that I like on 2020 that they didn't have on present Mars Curiosity is a helicopter, solar-powered helicopter. They want it, they're going to have it fly off ahead of the rover, investigate what's around, give them a real quick look of what's there. It'll come down and land. It'll be able to fly about 2 minutes a day, they said, with a complete recharge on a daily basis. So that sounds really, really interesting. And that has been funded. So that's what I'd like to see, the thing flying above the new rover and taking pictures and sending it back. Many flights have gone up and come back from the space station with crews on it. They have different expedition crews we've talked about. And then one of the things we talked about is the boosters for this space launch system that's going to be launching the SLS, 2018.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Launch for the static test out in Promontory, Utah. It's the second time they've done that. And each booster gives off 3.5 million pounds of thrust. So you combine that with two boosters and the rockets that will be on the new SLS rocket, and you're going to have more thrust than you had with Saturn V that went to Mars. So that's coming up. 2018 should be, the end of 2018 should be an interesting year. Talking, of course, about the Voyager spacecraft. And something recently I found, they aimed radio telescopes toward Voyager 1 as Voyager 1 was transmitting. And just like when you have radio telescopes looking at stars, and you're able to pick up the radio signals from the stars and make a picture out of it, they can now do that with Voyager 1, even so it's, 39, probably almost 40 astronomical units past, you know, out past us. And it's 104, I think 137 AU. So they can actually take a picture, and it comes out like a little streak. Even if the Voyager is moving and the Earth is moving, and you know, they can actually see a little streak of where the Voyager is. So that was pretty good. I sort of picture on that, and I actually saved that picture.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I already asked this WS to end. Maybe I should have separated this for 2 years. We had the for 2 weeks. We had the Juno spacecraft going to orbit around Pluto. I was successful in 2013. I got to transmit signals from here, Ron Cockerman, along with a couple of thousand other hams, with faux CW transmission to check to see if the plasma mechanism was working on that spacecraft before it got out to Jupiter, as it was doing an Earth flyby, and that was pretty interesting. So, let me drop it. I don't want to say here about these sounding rockets. Whatever. I'll try to go through this quick. Dawn spacecraft is now around Ceres. We followed that through its full escapades going around the asteroid Vesta. Now it's around Ceres and still in orbit around it. Doing very good. Let's see, we talked about the Juno mission and the Jupiter cam. The camera on board, everything's working, but they expect that to fail probably and within a couple of years. That mission now is, instead of a year and a half mission, it's now probably going to be a 4-year mission. They've had to extend that for different reasons. Let me drop it. Okay. Talked about Kepler finding new planets, or Kepler 2, in its new configuration. It's just found about 100 or more planets. That worked out good. That thing is still operating. It's trailing Earth as it goes around in orbit. I expect this year, 2017, there's a race to the moon for little spacecraft to land on the moon. Moon Express is one company, and there's a couple of the other companies, and they all have contracts. They needed contracts by the end of 2017 to do this, because there's something called the Google Prize. If they can get to the moon, land the spacecraft on the moon, take pictures, move 500 meters, take more pictures, they're going to collect $20 million. And plus, I really don't think they care about that, but it's their future, you know, in moon exploration, going there, maybe mining the moon. Who knows what they plan on doing. But that's one of the things that these private companies are involved with. It's not only from us, you know, our country, but other countries are involved in it. Whoever gets to the moon first gets $20 million and does what I said. Take pictures, move 500 meters, take more pictures. Talked about the ITER. Let's see. I don't want to repeat myself, but there's a lot of things that I've done, but they've done up there. Looking at this one topic, Kate Rubin was an astronaut on the International Space Station. She managed to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
She said they did that. So, a lot of firsts. OSIRIS-REx went up. OSIRIS-REx is on the way to Bennu, an asteroid. Plans on taking some material from the asteroid and bringing it back and landing it here. in the Utah desert, 2020. I could go through what OSIRIS REx stands for, but I'm not going to do that because I can feel I'm running out of time. Rosetta mission came to an end. That took 10 years to get out to the asteroid belt. That was all solar panels. It had the Philae lander, and they had lost that for like a year. And then, sure enough, in September, they wound up photographing it with their spacecraft, with the Rosetta spacecraft. Now they know exactly where the landed. It was designed to last not too, you know, long enough to recharge its batteries, but it wound up landing in the shade, therefore killing the whole program. I talked about Jeff Bezos before. He's now building the New Glenn. The New Glenn is down in Florida. New Glenn is a big rocket. I mean, it's almost as big as the Saturn V that he plans on launching into orbit, and first flight is scheduled for late 1919. Blue Origin is the name of that company, and he plans on, you know, putting people on this thing. He wants to either paying people or, you know, or use it for research. And it's definitely capable of going to Mars. If he wants to go to Mars with Elon Musk, he can do it. Let's see. We have, right now, Kimbrough is on, you know, Shane Kimbrough, astronaut. He's on board the International Space Station. As long as he's up there with Peggy Whitman, and they're the ones that did the EVA that I talked about earlier. They've changed out some batteries. Each battery is like heavier than a piano. So, and they're doing six of them, installing six of them. So that's pretty interesting. And they'll be doing that again next, next Friday. Elon Musk, in September, he showed off his interplanetary transportation system that he plans on going to Mars with. He's got a rocket bigger than the Saturn V that he plans on sending to Mars, and he's got long term goals of putting 100 people per flight. Might happen many decades from now, but that's his goal on this particular rocket. In the beginning, he plans on just, you know, sending, you know, half a dozen people at a time to eventually start a colonization of the that planet. So we talked about the Deep Space Network. I go onto that website quite a bit. That's one of the things that we do quite a bit, talking about that. Also, communications on the International Space Station in October. They came out with information that the Ericsson radio had failed. They've been using that since 2001 to contact students around the country or around the world. So that now there's a new radio on its way up there. So right now they plan on using the Kenwood TMD-710 in the Russian segment to continue making contacts. In October, was very good for Orbital ATK that launches the Antares Cygnus rocket from Virginia. They got back on track. A lot of people from Long Island got to see that go up, see the reddish light, the reddish glow in the horizon as that thing went up into the air. I don't want to forget China. China has now another space station up there, Tiangong 2. But already they're abandoning it because they plan on doing Tiangong 3. The first space station is eventually going to burn up in the atmosphere. The second space station, they just sent one crew up there to see if they could stay up there a month, a record for them. And they did that, and they came back. And then eventually, they will have like five segment international space station that they're going to build. And the first segment is supposed to go up next year. Some people sent me a letter. They want to know how many satellites are orbiting Mars. I remember talking about that toward the end of the year. And right now there's six working ones. There's the Mars Odyssey, one up there in 2001. You have the Mars Express.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
New one that we just sent up, and it got into orbit last year. And now the Trace spacecraft that sent up by the European Space Station, and then the one I mentioned that went up by India, the Amman Space Station, I think that was the last one that went into, orbit was Trace by the European Space Agency. And also Virgin Mobile, Virgin Galactic, is in the news toward the end of the year. Last month, they sent up a manned vehicle. They launched it from a carrier, and it comes down through the atmosphere and lands on the Earth. A couple of test flights that they're making. It's not powered yet. I think within a month or two, they're gonna light the rocket and see how that goes. Toward the very end of the year, in December, we watched the Pegasus spacecraft launch with the eight Cygnus satellites that are going to look at all the hurricanes once they become operational. That was very successful. Glad to see that. And there's been an HTV launch. An HTV is another Japanese launch, and that was toward the end. Let me drop it. So, you know, I hope that the next year, 2017, is equal to or better than 2016 for technology and space exploration. So find out. there's many sources, but find out information about these topics. But to me, one of the better ways to keep informed with ham radio. Ham radio community, of course, listening to Weimar TechNet. We're on 8 o'clock and 12 o'clock every Sunday on this frequency, and other linked repeaters. That's the place to go. This is WS2N for, I guess, SpaceNet 234B. Back to you, Dick. I'm out of breath. How do you do it?
Dick and 2BM, I have a question for Paul.
Fire away with the question, Rich. Wait for the beeps.
Thank you, Dick. And Paul, why would they want to mine the moon? Are there any valuable things in the soil?
All kinds of minerals and things like that they've detected. So, you know, is it worth it to dig it out and bring it back to Earth? Not now, but maybe in the future. You know, if you need to have space travel real cheap. Good to know that they could do something like that, because they might be able to use some of the materials not to bring back to Earth, but to convert into useful products that they can actually use on the moon if they ever set up some kind of habitat or outpost there. Rich, back here.
Okay, Paul, thank you. I marvel at what you know. Back to Ned and to Rio. I'm done.
Good question, KC2OAS, Mark.
Go right ahead, Mark.
Two questions. One is, I didn't watch that report on the news, but I want to know a short take about what you know about Nibiru Planet X. which is supposed to be showing itself this year, in a couple of months. And the other thing is, why is it that when you are in a flight, in a plane, or they take pictures from the moon, you can't see the stars? Oh, and by the way, I don't think we're supposed to be going to the moon. I think we're told not to go back there. But over to you, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah, I know when the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, they could see stars. They could see them quite clearly. In fact, it was unbelievable when they said what they saw as they're flying. But when they take pictures and are on the moon, I think the settings that they have on the cameras are really for looking at the surface of the moon, and you know, the stars aren't going to come out. I'm sure if they adjusted their cameras properly or, you know, pointed their, you know, maybe they could bring, you know, telescopes up next time and it'll be out of this world, especially if they go to the dark side of the moon. That Planet X thing, well, they're calling it Planet 9. So they expect maybe in the next 3 years, they hope that one of the groups that are searching for it, and there aren't many, will be able to pick it out. They know exactly where to look in the sky because of all the calculations that they made with all the gravitational pull on all these Kuiper belt objects. The way they're arranged, the way they're moving, they know that something's affecting them. They all could not be in a location that they are without this unknown planet being there. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this was on 60 Minutes tonight. It was the third program. And Planet 9, the new Planet 9, they think it's going to be approximately 10 times the mass of the Earth. It's at 50 billion miles. Pluto is, we keep saying that the Voyager spacecraft is three times the distance to Pluto, and it's at 12 billion miles. So I guess Pluto is something like 3 and a fraction billion miles. So 50 billion miles for new planet number 9. That's way out there. Pluto has an orbit of not quite 300 years, 200 and some odd years. And this new planet at that distance, what's the orbital period there, Paul? Something like 3 or 30,000 years? Over to you, Paul, KQIW.
They said 15,000 years. And Pluto's less than 300. Pluto's 248, but, you know. So 248 compared to 15,000. What a difference. And what they say was 50, they say 50 billion, I think they said 50 billion miles out. I think Pluto's like 3.6. Back to you, Dick.
That's really down the road a piece. When it comes to a significant number, there's a significant number of people out there who believe the Apollo lunar landing missions were all done in Hollywood, that it never really took place. And some of the crazy things they use as proof is, one, there's no air in the moon, so how can the flag be waving? Well, the flag had pieces of wire inside of the cloth to hold it in the right position. Number two, why are there no stars in the picture? When you're taking a picture on the moon, the main thing you're taking a picture of is a spacecraft, a man in a space suit, the lunar soil. All of those objects are in sunlight at high noon. But the distance from the sun to the moon, or the distance from the Earth to the sun, here we go. Sun to Earth and sun to moon, very close to the same distance. Therefore, the amount of sunlight you get on the moon is almost identical to what you get at high noon on the Earth. So an object that's properly exposed in your photograph at high noon is a zillion f-stops away from the right setting of the camera in order to take a picture of the stars. we drop? Now, it turns out that a human eye, by way of the adjustment of your scotopic vision versus photopic vision, in other words, when your eyes are dark adapted, they're a zillion dB more sensitive. You know the effect you have when you're watching a dim movie in a movie theater, and you come out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the sky is so bright, it hurts your eyes. That's because your eyes have to readapt to a daytime viewing versus nighttime viewing. That combined with the iris of the eye and the fact that your retina has a very large dynamic range, you put that all together. An astronaut in his spacesuit, as long as he's not looking at a spacecraft or not looking at the lunar soil, if he's looking straight up in the sky and he waits a little bit, his eyes will see stars. And so the astronauts never did it, but they could have, in theory, set the camera just right, aim that up at the sky, and they would have seen stars while they're on the moon. So that's a strong misconception that people have. Let me drop it.
Let me respond.
Go ahead. Who is the person who wants to respond? Give us your call letters and name. T2RIW in the check net. My name is Dick.
Dick, it's Mark, KC2OIS. Well, you know, when you look up at the sky, either at sunset or sunrise, you can still see stars. Now, it was Armstrong that said that he never saw any stars, ever. So I'm just taking it from the astronaut's point of view.
He was the very first astronaut that touched down on the moon. He had a very tight schedule, a very brief period that he's allowed to be on the moon. What you're asking is, did he do the experiment to stop all of his operations, look up at dark sky, look away from the soil of the moon, look away from all objects on the moon, wait for his eyes to be dark adapted, look at the dark sky, and then see if he saw stars? Did he do that experiment? Of course not. Did later astronauts do that? I think the answer is yes. So let's ask Paul about that. I'm guessing later astronauts were hearing these stories about, hey, there's no stars in the picture. And I'd like to believe that the astronauts on Apollo 15, 16, or 17, particularly on 17, where you had a real scientist on board, I'll bet you he did the experiment to look at the sky in just the right way so that he could see the stars. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, the first guy I remember talking about stars. He was the fourth man on the moon. Went up with Conrad. And in fact, he's a very good artist today, nowadays. Makes a lot of space pictures. And of course, when they were in orbit, they saw stars. And you're not going to see anything better than what they saw in orbit. And they would use star trackers to get their bearings. You know, there was no GPS up there, so they had star trackers. You know, in fact, Apollo 13 had to, they wanted to use the stars, but they wound up using Earth and the Sun because there was debris following them, and the debris looked like stars, so they couldn't use the stars. But all the flights that, you know, anytime they weren't facing the sun, they could see stars. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's somebody who wants to make further comment. Is that you, Mark?
To get in. Go ahead, station.
One of the other things that Paul mentioned earlier is the water in the spacesuit. You have circulating fluid in order to, there's a garment that the astronauts wear inside the spacesuit, which has a whole lot of channels of water passing through it, in order to control the temperature that the astronaut is exposed to. You have to do that because in that spacesuit, in space, the side facing the sun is going to get hot. The side facing away from the sun is going to get real cold. And that would be very uncomfortable if you didn't wear this garment that has fluid passing through it. But if there's a leakage of that fluid, and you combine little droplets of water floating around in the breathable air while you're in weightlessness, if those droplets go into your nose or into your mouth while you're breathing, you've got a problem, because many people, in fact most people, have a very strong response that you're not aware of, and often it's called the foreign object reflex of your trachea. If a small amount of fluid enters your trachea while you're breathing, your throat will close itself off, because the body goes into a protection mechanism where it thinks it's going to be drowned. Let me drop it. And it stops you from breathing. If you had water leaking into your helmet while you're doing deep sea diving, until the water got so high that it got above your nose, it wouldn't give you serious problem. But in weightlessness, the water is not sitting in some convenient location. It's floating around freely in your breathable air. And so when you're about to take a breath inward, how do you stop the water droplets floating in the air from going into your mouth, nose, or whatever, and getting into your trachea? So it's a very dangerous situation. An extremely small amount of water floating around the spacesuit could drown the astronaut. I'll bet you a couple of thimblefuls of water is probably a potentially lethal amount. Is that roughly what you know as you read about this one, Paul? WS2N, KQIW?
Yeah, and it was a little bit more than that with quite a bit of water for Luca Parmitano from the European Space Agency. When he was doing that walk, the EVA with Copra, correction, Copra was the other guy that had the problem later on. Luca was 2013, and then this year was Copra with the, it happened to be the same suit, identical suit, so they thought there was a problem. They sent it back on Dragon, on a SpaceX return flight. Dragon is the only one right now that actually brings stuff back, science equipment, spacesuits, and they determined what the problem was with the suit. It could creep up again the way it's designed. So compensated for it. Now they have some kind of padding and some kind of sucking device or something. They've compensated for this. So, for instance, this EVA that they were doing on Friday with Peggy Whitman and Shane Kimbrough replacing the batteries, they have this new equipment in their spacesuits. So if there is any kind of a water problem, leaking problem, they don't think they'll have that same effect. But with Luca, they aborted the mission. There's a difference between terminating and aborting. With the culprit, they terminated. They said, okay, let's bring everything back. That means, you know, wrap everything up. Abort means just drop everything. Who cares if it's hanging off the end of the International Space Station or not? Just get back into the Quest lab.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
So I think you're saying that when they aborted that mission because of water floating around in the breathable air of the spacesuit, I think you're saying that they rapidly recognized that as a life-threatening situation. And the possibility existed that that particular astronaut would have to be rescued. I guess this is one of the reasons why whenever you have a spacewalk, you try to do it not as one man, but as a two-man operation. Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, you always see a buddy system. The Ed White days are over when you send a guy out by himself, you know. But I saw an interview with Luca Parmitano when he was on board the International Space Station, and he was talking about his family and what they think about the safety of it, of everything, including the spacewalks. And 2 days later, he was out on a spacewalk and he almost got himself killed. So I see he's doing good. He's still with the program, and in fact, on Friday's spacewalk, Luca was Capcom. I think I mentioned that earlier. He He was COPCOM sitting at the desk of mission control, talking the astronauts through all the different steps of replacing these gigantic, heavy nickel hydrogen batteries with the new lithium ion batteries. Lithium ion batteries weigh like 520 pounds, and the old ones are over 700 pounds. So, and now it's not a 1-to-1 ratio. They're getting rid of 12 big batteries and replacing them with 6 for the same amount of amp hours. So, I'd like to see the next spacewalk, see if there's any problems on Friday. It's going to be Shane Kimbrough again, but Peggy Whitson's she's not going the second time. The guy from the European Space Agency's going, Thomas Piquette, he's going. So, it usually takes about 6-7 hours, but very successful last time. They got get ahead work done, and we'll see how they do this Friday. No water in the spaces.
You know, I'm pretty naive, but I'm going to make some guesses, Paul. If you've got droplets of water floating around in its weightlessness inside of the spacesuit in your breathable air, to make sure that you're breathing air and not droplets of water, what could you do? If you see some droplets of water directly in front of you, and if you blow out of your mouth some air and you try to make the droplets of water stick to the helmet, if you can get them to go over to the wall and stick to the wall, then because of capillary action and the way water adheres to a wall, you would think it would stay there and it would be a safer situation. However, I see a problem. I'll bet you they carefully coat the inside of the helmet with something to make sure it doesn't fog up. As such, they've coated it with something that makes it shed water. So therefore, even that protection mechanism probably wouldn't work. I bet they haven't, other than this absorber material you just described, I bet you they've got no good workaround for droplets of water floating in the breathable air. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, and that coating, they've changed that too. They do have a coating on the inside, but they used to use a chemical type of coating. But, you know, they didn't know they were going to have this water problem. And there was one droplet that got onto that and then into Chris Cassidy's eye. And he got himself into a bad situation. They didn't stop the spacewalk. We eventually cleared it out after about fighting with the thing for 15 minutes or so, trying to close his eye, open his eye. And they finally determined after testing the inside of the helmet that it was whatever was on the surface. So they had to change that. So the purpose of it, maybe is that reason. I don't know if that's the purpose of this cleaning substance that was on the inside of all these helmets. But whatever it is, I know they've changed that procedure out because of Chris Cassidy's problem. He was an astronaut from Canada. And eventually, he was commander on the International Space Station. First one from Canada. Very active. I think he's now in charge of the astronaut corps. It was Peggy Whitson, but she signed herself off to go back on the flight to check on that. But I know that was a problem with this cleaning surface on the inside of the glass part of the helmet. Mixing with moisture, getting into your eye. Again, a freak out type of situation back in there.
So when that droplet came back into his eye, I'm guessing it would created a strong stinging operation. Is that what you're saying, Paul? Wait for the beeps.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Exactly. And I remember him saying that he's opening and closing his eye. And it was getting worse and worse. But then eventually it cleared, and then they were able to continue the spacewalk. But it came close to stopping that one.
I'm guessing with a whole lot of blinking, eventually enough tears flowed out of his eye to wash the stuff clear enough that the stinging at least got to a tolerable level. Boy, sound like fun. You don't really have a windshield washer in there. There's no wind.